Episode 1, The Folder. All right.
Is it on?
Yeah, it's all going. Yeah, okay.
Shut the door.
Okay. That's Daniel Healy, head of sports science at Vertigo. And on the day I recorded our first conversation, we had just met for the first time. Now, I knew a little bit about Daniel. I knew he was a
sports scientist, exercise physiologist, and nutritionist.
I knew he was a coach. He has a master's degree in sports science. I knew that cycling was his thing, but I don't think I had any idea about all the things that he's done. Of course, there's the pro cycling experience.
I've worked with Bjarne and Mick in their most recent pro team, that was Tinkoff Saxo. And before that, I was also head of sports science at BNC.
So that's one part of the cycling side of things, which we will dig into a little bit later. Daniel, though, was head of nutrition for High Performance New Zealand Sport in the 2008 to 2012 Olympic cycle. So what unfolded as I got further and further into our conversation was Daniel's thirst for knowledge and openness to learning from any sport or professional, which over 20 plus years means that the depth and breadth of information that he's exposed himself to, and more importantly, sifted through to develop his script, as he calls it, is just staggering. And not only did he get to see
how big the human engine is, and how malleable it is to training.
He also set in motion a
constant process, revising my script.
This script, which is a series of sessions he uses for the pro riders he coaches, from the very beginning, all ended up in one place, the folder. From Vertigo, this is Inside, opening up the professional cycling and sports worlds. I'm Damien Roos, and this week, the story of one coach's pursuit of knowledge. It's also the story of being open to new ideas and how we filter the information we come across so we can get the most out of it in the real world. Coaches and even riders need to get information from a wide variety of sources. Peer-reviewed articles, peer-to-peer learning, athletes, etc. This diversification is a strength. So is being equipped with a well-functioning BS meter. For Daniel, his formal education was his starting point for collecting information.
From those very early days, looking at old journals in the back of the library, I was always just interested. Cycling came to me late, but how cyclists train and why you would do 3 minutes on and 3 minutes off and whatever it was. So I got interested from day one at university in just sets and reps. Then that turned into a much bigger passion where I'd go to bookshops all over Sydney. I'm originally from Sydney. And in the early 2000s, I put together a folder that was actually periodized. It was using old terms though. It was like base training and this and this and this. And then I would just find Cycling Weekly magazine, Cycling News, in fact, it was called Bill's Cycling Pages back then, wherever I could find anything about training. And of course, doing all the bunch rides. And as I'm doing these bunch rides with all the information that was available inside the exercise physiology lab at the time, I would see a disconnect between what people were doing on the road and what they were doing in their training programs outside of the academic environment. And it was multifactorial, actually, when I think about it. There was discussions in the bunch about having steak before, you know, big training rides. Some people even then were starting to avoid carbohydrates, and all these little fads and trends would eke their way into people's training programs. So I just kept an ear out. You know, I was doing some pretty big Ks at the time, and my master's study was using AIS cyclists and the best riders from around the Sydney area. So I would tune into them. They were doing long, long tests in my lab, like really long tests of exhaustion. And that allowed hours and hours of just talking time. You know, what do you eat? How do you train? And you just won that race. How did you prepare? You're going overseas with the national team. What sort of training are you going to do when you go to Mexico? Because there were legendary altitude camps that they would do at the time. Yep. So all of these, just these strands of information, I was pulling them together over time and then basically going back to the books. And so there was this big gap between the knowledge base that we were taught through very formal and structured education and what was actually being done on the road.
And Daniel took this information literally out onto the road. But before we dig into that, let's take a moment to understand why findings from scientific studies need the extra testing out on the road.
Everything that works in the lab doesn't necessarily work out on the road. When you see a laboratory study, they're looking for something really specific. It could be a nutrition intervention where there's an exercise test involved. It could just be looking at the benefits of high-intensity sprint intervals and how that may affect mitochondria, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest lesson that I've learned over time is not to get too caught up in those details. And often less is also more. When you see some of these sprint studies coming out, yeah, they're done in a lab environment. Yes, we're looking for a really specific effect. Yes, we're going to load you up with all of these short, sharp efforts. But in a continuum, if you're a professional bike rider, you probably can't do that many efforts because you're traveling to races, you're recovering from a race. If it's not that, there's the normal stresses and strains of normal life combined with a 20 to 25 hour training week.
In other words, studies can be so narrow in their focus, they miss the big picture of a cyclist. And we're not just talking about pro cyclists here. We're talking about everybody and their extra life stresses and their whole picture of their entire life and how that fits into their cycling and training. When Daniel took the early information about training literally out onto the road, he started with the youngest riders.
12-year-olds, 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds, I was standing on the side of the road with a clipboard, more often than not standing there in the rain. As they would ride around, there was no power meters, but I'd send them up and down hills. I'd be sort of looking at their heart rate and trying to juggle three or four guys at a time. But these riders getting results is what really hooked me on this thing called training. One of them won a local club race after a few months of me working with him, and that was such a big deal at the time. You know, it was confirmation that this little kid was, you know, going in the right direction, but also confirmation for me that taking some of this stuff from science and actually applying it to a young rider who's still developing himself, that there's a pathway here, that this could work. That same rider, fast forward a few years later, went on to win, I think it was 3 world titles in the track world championships in 2008 in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And they were the good events, right? When I say the good events, they're the big ones, the marquee events. He won the Madison. He won the Team Pursuit, and then he won the Omnium all at one time. So this little fire that had started on this thing called coaching by standing on the side of the road in Centennial Park suddenly got results on a much bigger stage. Yep. And I distinctly remember when this rider, Luke Davidson's his name, when he came back from that championships, he was on the front page of the local newspaper, and I just thought that was the best thing. So I didn't need much more confirmation after that.
This system was also confirmed with a big win on the road.
One night I got a phone call, late January. And it was a friend of mine saying, Daniel, you're not going to believe it, but Pete just won. And I'm like, I did a double take. I said, okay, won what? The elite national road cycling title. He worked as a bike courier. He was trained in education, so he had his teaching qualification in his pocket, which was great. But he spent all day up and down the streets of Sydney delivering packages. Then after that, we'd go to the Tuesday night racing, which is super intense in Sydney, and he'd win.
At the time, though, Daniel had just started a position with High Performance New Zealand Sport.
One day, I saw an advertisement for High Performance Sport New Zealand. They called themselves Sport New Zealand at the time. This is like 2008. And they were looking for gold medal experts or people that have got the years of university training but have also got hands-on experience producing champion athletes. And I thought, well, that is talking to me. And there was a few jobs. There was an exercise physiology job that they needed to fill. Mm-hmm. There was a nutrition role they needed to fill. There was power science, psychology, and there was a motor learning from memory, something like that. And I looked at the physiology one and I thought, that could be good. But this nutrition role, to work with the top sports people in a big government-funded sports initiative, was really, really appealing. So I sent my resume in, did the interviews, government jobs, so lots and lots of interviews, and then got the job. And then so went to New Zealand at the very end of 2008, sorry, and straight away started working in sports I knew nothing about, absolutely nothing.
And this was an opportunity to diversify his knowledge and get to work in other sports, understanding different nutritional demands.
I was working in hockey. I was working in netball, swimming, and there was, after that, also yachting.
But the functional things of nutrition are the same in those regards.
Well, this is the thing. Performance nutrition is exactly that. You've got the organism that's put under some sort of stress or strain. It needs some nutrients before it trains, during training, or racing, whatever it may well be, and then that recovery period. But having a background in cycling, you know, it's this ultra endurance exercise, you don't get more stressed in any other sport, I don't think. Cycling is really extreme when you bear it down to what it is. 4, 5, 6 hours training every single day, long training rides where you've got to get used to eating and drinking. That's a whole world unto itself. So I had that background and I just applied it to lots of different sports and it went super well.
But it didn't stop there. Daniel also had an insight into how other sports run their coaching programs.
Yeah, but also just having open ears and open eyes when you're seeing, you know, expertly run programs, right, world-renowned programs, with coaches that have far more experience than I had at the time. So rowing, I was in the New Zealand rowing program for a couple of years.
Ready, call, we get back to the relaxation.
And that opened my eyes. Those guys, those girls, are tough. They ride in the dark down to the rowing shed in the morning. And New Zealand's not warm. There's 3 or 4 days of summer in New Zealand. Exactly, exactly. They ride down there in the dark. They get on the water in the dark. They'll do 2 hours. Then they'll come back, have a little snack, straight into the gym, then ride home, have a little sleep, come back and do another 2 hours. And that's almost every day. And then you've got a specific discipline inside rowing that I was stationed on, and that's the lightweight rowers. So the boys and guys, the guys and girls have to be really lightweight. They're generally quite tall. And so managing their nutrition was really important. But watching how much work they could do, I took away resilience and just the huge potential that the human organism has to endure endurance exercise. And that was really taken from the rowers. They did stuff that I never thought was possible. Yet I'm at the rowing shed every other day. And seeing these guys and girls also go on to win gold medals. The New Zealand rowing program is, I won't say second to none, but let's just say they, for a small country, they bat way above their average.
So I think it's important that you had this experience. To me, because for so long, sports are just siloed. No one talks to anybody. Maybe in a high performance system, in a country that's developing their systems like New Zealand, Australia, they talk to each other a little bit. It's where we're at today. 10 years ago, I don't think many sports were talking to each other at all.
No, but I also had the benefit that I could duck in and duck out. Hey, I got promoted to the national lead role in nutrition in New Zealand, and that was after being there for about 1 year. So I got to then cherry pick the sports I really wanted to work in. I loved working in all the sports I was in, but I was also spread too far. So, of course, I targeted Bike NZ. I targeted the rowing program, triathlon, and then, yeah, I had a little bit of time with netball as well, which was also fun. But I kept them as my sports, and I watched how the coaches prepared them. I watched their recovery techniques. There was also a big sports science program or sports science support network behind all those sports.
And this was another area that you wouldn't really think about in a program like this, the opportunity to learn from other professionals.
So speaking to the physios was really important for me. Speaking to the strength and conditioning guys was also really important to me. You know, using weight training for the sprint athletes. Again, I watched how they did that and taken a few clues and a few little tidbits with me. Sure. And all that information does find its way into the current training sessions and training programs.
And now we get to the point of years and years of collecting and testing and filtering, and it leads to the real test, professional cycling. Daniel's story of how he got into pro cycling is one of persistence and honing his craft. Love was ultimately what put a series of actions into motion that would have him on the hunt for a job in pro cycling. During one of his trips to Belgium with Bike NZ, he met a German woman, who is now his wife, by the way. But at a certain point, he took a 3-month tourist visa in Germany to stay with her and follow his passion and set himself the goal of getting a job in pro cycling. Even with Daniel's experience, he's the first to admit that
the chances of that happening were really slim. Lots of nights spent staring at the ceiling.
It really came down to the wire when he only had a few weeks left. And after sending out big, long, detailed emails to every single pro team, he got a warm introduction to Alan Piper at BMC. And after a long meeting with Piper in his new hometown of Freiburg, Germany,
The call came. Daniel, would you work with us?
And what was that position?
That was straight away into the head of sports science at BMC.
And so Daniel's career within a formal pro cycling team was underway. Starting from scratch, Daniel was tasked with setting up a system with an online monitoring system to come up with a really simplified way of conveying to management which riders were up, which ones were down, who's on form, who isn't, and who's looking to be on track for races in 1 month, 2 months, or 3 months' time. At BMC, Daniel met Bobby Julik, a person with strong connections to the sport as an ex-rider, but also being involved with coaching at other pro teams like Team Sky. And Julik made an introduction to Bjarne Riis, who at the time was putting together a new team, which would later become Tinkoff Saxo. But at this point, Daniel is still on his pursuit of knowledge. And it's here in pro cycling where a new source of information presents itself in the most unlikely of places.
And you're sitting at the dinner table with, let's see, an ex-world champion here, the current world champion here, a director sportif that's worked with these two riders for many years. And the favourite conversation in pro tour teams, apart from video games and all the rest of it, is training. The chef, the massage therapist, the bus driver, the DS, the team owner, everyone is actually really interested. Everyone has an opinion on training, which is sometimes good and sometimes bad. But given that it's such a passionate topic and everyone that works in cycling is so passionate, the information, if you've got your ears open, that goes across the dining table, two world champions sitting there, one past and one current, a director sportif that's won monuments, and getting down right inside some of these sets and reps, why they work and why they work in the field is one thing. Then going back and looking at first principles and scientific basis of these things is another. So you might take one idea, put it into a training session, tweak it just a little bit, and I might frame this with sprints. You know, they might be talking about some 12-second sprints, which has happened once. The difference between 12 seconds and 10 seconds is 2 seconds, but nevertheless, it was a really specific number. Mm-hmm. If we scale that back to, say, 8 to 10 seconds, and then we start framing it in terms of the phosphate system, then that little bit of information put into a scientific framework becomes a new and easily validated training session or workout.
And also in a pro environment, you get a chance to be next to the riders and again, test out these ideas, especially at training camps where you get to see firsthand how your ideas play out in real time. But you also get to sit down and talk to other coaches on the team.
I've learned a lot from some of the best coaches that are out there. And we have conversations like this, not because we're looking for the Holy Grail, mainly because it's fun, it's interesting to find out how to execute some of these reps, how to make them a little bit better. And one person's input will lead to a new idea, which is then tried, which then leads to a new series of sets and reps, and then it grows and grows. So really, this information is the sum total of my curiosity, the people around me, the custodians of this information, and also the now that we're packaging all this for the general public, it's the whole VirtuGo team that have helped filter some of this.
Now, I'm not going to harp on it, but it will come up. Daniel and I both work at the same company called VirtuGo. And the whole aim of our company is to bring the world of pro cycling to all cyclists. You will hear us talk about VirtuGo from time to time, but we are working together on this show to open up the world of pro cycling and to some extent the world of high performance sport and taking those lessons to all cyclists to get better and faster or whatever your goal is. Daniel is going to be the filter, and this show is going to be the folder, the collection of ideas that have been filtered down for real world use. We will refine common topics and uncover new ones. But whatever we talk about, it's going to come back down to how can we use this in our cycling? How can you use this in your cycling? And while putting this episode together, I was thinking about the most useful parts of this whole topic. Other than actually getting hands on Daniel's folder, what I came up with is Daniel's process for filtering information. So let's go through an example of Daniel's process and how something makes it into the folder. So the big thing that I did want to talk about is this process of how things make it into your script and your collection of workouts. If you have any examples of the process that you've gone through to use this.
Oh, I have a lot. The most recent one happened, I would say, 3 years ago. And I know that sounds like a long time because in the last 3 years, it's been a process of evolving what's already in the training library. Yeah, a really defining series of intervals were put in front of me from a different sport. And, okay, some cycling teams were using these particular intervals, but they had their origin, you know, in the pool. So I found it really interesting, firstly, the nature of them, the intensity of how they were done, and the intervals I'm talking about here is called capacity. It's go as hard as you can for a certain period of time, and then you back off onto what is the normalized power of normal race pace or a high zone three. And there's various ways you can do capacity, which I'll get to in a minute, because it shows the evolution of one particular interval set. So traditionally used in swimming, and then this information migrated out of the pool over to cycling. And a few big proteins were already working with these intervals once I found out about them. So I first saw them, and we were in training camp, and we were practicing, you know, teaching the guys how to do these particular intervals. But where they made particular sense for cycling is that a capacity effort can also be called a breakaway effort or a race-defining effort, where you jump off the front of the bunch as hard as you can go and then settle onto the pace that the bunch is doing because you've already got your gap. So it's building that capacity or ability to be able to make these breakaway efforts.
But can we take a step back and do you know why they use them in the pool?
My swimming knowledge, you can write on the back of a post-it note.
Yeah, I'm not trying to put you on the spot here as far as...
No, I'm being honest. It's a really small post-it note, and that's me in swimming. But I did spend a lot of time with some really good swim coaches, and a lot of their methods, their training was such high volume, and the swimmers lapped up, pardon the pun, this kind of workout. But why they came up with it, I don't know. It could have been a dose of common sense. It could have been three or four coaches sitting around after a swim session, in much the same way we develop certain in cycling.
Swimming in a, like training in a pool, I don't know the first thing either about it. Like, I don't know why you do certain things. I do know they do a big volume, similar to professional cyclists.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that volume has something to do with not just the amount of time in the water, but the intensity you're forced to swim at. There's probably no such thing as a recovery swimming pace. You're still dragging yourself through the water. And I know that for cyclists, which is probably a topic for another conversation, but I use swimming a lot actually in the last couple of years for that one very reason. You're always in, just to get your body up and down the pool, you're in a tempo power zone, if you want to think of it that way. So everything in the pool is a little bit more difficult than outside. Nevertheless, if the parameters here or the discussion piece is how does something make it onto the final playbook, it has to show some sort of specificity to some part of cycling. That's the first thing that's in my head. So when I saw capacity, I was like, wow, that's a really hard effort. And then you back it up with an effort that's also pretty hard. And then after a bit of thinking about it, it's like, well, that could also be called just a breakaway effort. And then suddenly it made sense. And now another part to that is I've had riders actually evolve these for me. So I can step you through this process, actually.
Yeah.
So I found out about capacity, and there's a process here where over 4 weeks, doing full capacity, you'll build the riders up from doing 1 minute as hard as they can. Right? Usually, if you want to be nice to them, put a little climb under them so they've got something to leverage off. A particularly brutal form of capacity is just doing it on the flat. And if you're going into the classics, you've got to be able to do that stuff too. But nevertheless, apart from that little differentiation just there, it's start off week one, 1 minute as hard as you can go, and then it's 4 minutes at high zone three. And it's a sustained effort, right? Continuous effort, I should say, for 5 minutes. And they always need 5 to 10 minutes rest after it. In a good capacity session, you'll get maybe 3 or 4 really good reps out before they start to fall apart. So week one, 1 minute. Week two, 2 minutes. And 3 minutes at race pace. Week three, 3 minutes, full, full, full. And it's right about now in week three where your rider doesn't really like you that much, because 3 minutes going as hard as you can, with or without a climb, is a solid, focused effort. And, of course, the trailing edge on that is going to be 2 minutes at that race pace. Build up to 4 minutes with 1 minute at race pace. And then if someone can go really deep for 5 minutes and know and actually practice their recovery and training, like how long does it take for them to freshen up to do the next one, a five-minute hard effort is a tool or weapon that would demoralize anyone that's with you. There may be the first breakaway and there's a bigger bunch. The group gets whittled down. You've got 3 guys you want to get rid of and you don't have a sprint, but you've got this up your sleeve, then of course you're going to use it. And so it's not just applicable to the race, but it's then also teaching the riders how to use these weapons they've got. And if they're only doing 1 minute or 2 minute capacity efforts, such as in the women's pro peloton, usually 1 minute, 2 minute is enough to make a selection. But the men definitely use their 5 minute abilities with capacity. So There's an example of something coming from a different sport, translating really well into cycling. My filter's on. How can this actually be used in a race? And does it make sense? Yes, tick that box. So I've been running capacity ever since I found out about them. The only thing I'm getting better at is prescribing the right number of these intervals, because they're hard. And you don't do them unless you've got all the other phases in place. So you're fit, you're strong, you're powerful. And you're about to get really fast doing these things as well. Then they evolved. And riders would come back to me and say, you know, what about trying reverse capacity? What about doing, in week one, 4 minutes at the race pace and just finishing with a big 1 minute blowout? And using the example of, I'm just going to go from 1,000 meters out because I've got no sprint.
Yeah.
And that's two levels of specificity. It's one, specific to the condition, right, from 1,000 out. But that second layer is the rider doesn't have a sprint, so they have no option, right? So that's a really good thing to practice, I thought, came from a rider. So we practiced that. Then we practiced 3 minutes and then 2 minutes, as hard as you can go. Then we did it in reverse, right? Then we went over to 3 minutes with two, then four with one, and we didn't worry about five because five full is just five full. So that was from a guy that didn't have a sprint, and I used them a lot. Another evolution in capacity is doing them in a modified format earlier in the build. So you may be into your third phase, still doing a bit of strength work and starting to move into power, but you don't really want to have the guys going super, super deep and super, super hard just now. So you just instruct them, do a 90% effort. And this is where, the direction just there wasn't super specific, but when you're working with very experienced bike riders, they know how to dose an effort. Do an 80% effort for 1 minute, but then settle on to the high zone three. Because they're doing high zone three work anyway, doing engine builders at this time. Then the next week, let's do 2 minutes at that 80-85% and 3 minutes with that trailing edge at race pace, and so on and so forth. So you can do that. You can do a four-week build like that, and time, history has shown, if you can get 8 weeks of capacity done in that really neat order, start with modified, but overload them in the right, using the right metric, which is 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minute, and then run it again as full in the second four-week build, you get a better result and a happier athlete.
It's time for The Chaser, the segment of the show where I talk about something that will help you chase down your goals, whether it's a product, study, or a performance tip. This week, I wanted to pull out something from my talks with Daniel, something that repeatedly came up was this one particular lesson.
And that lesson is that less is more. A pro rider is no different than an executive or a housewife or a university student. They have their real life, except for a pro rider, their real life includes travel, particularly overseas if you live in the Southern Hemisphere. It includes travel to and from bike races. It involves the stresses and strains of the race itself. Then there's the training. So it's really easy to take a textbook approach, which I did, and this is a big learning point for me, to take a textbook approach and apply it in a textbook way to a rider that is basically living in a really randomized environment. The only certainty is the time that the race starts, and then the next race. And I've kept that experience and that situation I was in very close to me the whole way through. Pro riders, as humans, are very similar to everyone else, except they've got this extraordinary amount of travel they have to do. And that kind of background fatigue is very, very hard to quantify. So less is more.
A good lesson to take on board at any level. Simplification is also something we can pull from this. Not making things too hard or too complicated gives us a chance not to occupy as much brain space for your cycling. And this also frees up your time outside of cycling to recover and still fulfill the other roles you occupy in your life. Inside is produced by Vertigo and hosted by me, Damien Roos. If you enjoyed this show and you want to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell your riding buddies. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode or out on the road.